will be Tuesday, November 10th at 7:30 p.m. in Forum Hall of the K-State Union. This lecture will feature Juliet Shore, who will speak on Reflections of the Overworked American. This series is paid for by donations from the Office of the Provost, the Dean of the Arts and Sciences, various college departments, and private donations. Please notice the donation list in your program. The programs are printed on post-consumer recycled paper, and we would appreciate you recycling them for use at the last two lectures. Now I would like to introduce Scott Ettinger, who will introduce tonight's speaker.
We at the Lee Douglas Lecture Series are pleased to present to you Dr. Howard Zinn. Dr. Zinn received his BA and MA from New York University and his PhD from Columbia. He recently retired from Boston University's History Department. Dr. Zinn is known as an historian, author, and lecturer. He has authored over a dozen books on topics such as history, politics, and social movements. Over 60 of his articles have been published in various periodicals. In addition to books and articles, Dr. Zinn has written two plays. He has lectured at over 200 colleges and universities, here in the U.S. and abroad. Among them are Yale, MIT, Stanford, Northwestern, Tokyo University, Kyoto University, and the University of Amsterdam. His wide range of knowledge allows him to lecture on topics as the Constitution and the First Amendment, American law and the judicial system, U.S. foreign policy, and civil disobedience. Tonight's lecture will center around the foreign policy. Once again, we are very pleased to have Dr. Zinn here at K-State. Please help me in welcoming Dr. Howard Zinn.
Well, thank you. Can you all hear me? Yeah? Okay. Just want to make sure. Speakers don't like a word to be missed. So when we decided the title of this talk months ago, you always decide titles long before you really know what you're going to talk about, and then you somehow have to figure out how to make a connection. I think we decided we would pick the title sort of A New Foreign Policy. Justice Without War. Maybe you can figure out what that means. I hope that when I finish speaking, you will have a better idea than I do. But I want to step back from the election campaign. Well, maybe you psychologically have already stepped back from the election campaign. Because in an election campaign, what happens is everybody gets centered on this phenomenon, this choice, and because there's so much publicity and so much fanfare around it, you actually begin to think that the fate of the country, the historic fate of the country, is going to be decided by whether A or B gets, I'm sorry to refer to them as A or B, B or C, I guess, is more accurate, gets elected. And what that does, that it's a part of the American culture, this a kind of hysteria around election time, for months before election time, in which we all overvalue the importance of elections. I know this may offend some of you. I may say a lot of things tonight that may offend some of you, but there'll be a question period or a denunciation period, then you can say whatever you like. But I think it's dangerous to a democratic society to begin to think that the fate of the nation depends on whether you elect this person or that person, and that the supreme act of a citizen in a democracy is just to go to the polls every 4 years and choose between two candidates. I know you think there are three. He thinks there are three. Choose between two candidates, neither of whom you wanted in the first place. And it's a kind of Machiavellian intrusion into our culture, it seems to me. That is, when I say Machiavellian, I mean Machiavelli wrote as if all of us are the leader of the country, the prince, you see. And he wanted people to look at things through the eyes of the prince, the head of state. And very often, we in a democracy look on things that way. And we think that if there are serious problems in our country, well, all we have to do is elect a new president, and he will be our savior. And we sort of grow up, and we aren't helped very often by history books which present our history as the history of saviors, you know, history of presidents. This is the age of Jackson. This is the age of Lincoln. This is the age of Roosevelt. And we begin to think that our fate depends on having people who will somehow save us from our terrible problems. Now, that to me is the antithesis of democracy. Because it seems to me that the democracy depends on citizens not just going to the polls and electing somebody who will save us from our problems, but democracy depends upon people being active every day of the year, not just once in 4 years, thinking every day, speaking up every day of the year, participating in some way, joining some organization, in some way making yourself heard, so that you're not kind of some inert being whose only duty is to elect one of these two people in this very limited multiple choice test. See. So I want to look at our foreign policy, thinking about a new foreign policy. I guess that suggests that I think we need a new foreign policy. And I do. We've been following roughly the same foreign policy for a long time. That is, and it's a foreign policy that both Democrats and Republicans have joined in. And you've heard the expression bipartisan foreign policy. And in fact, I remember recently I guess it was in the vice presidential debate that Quayle said something about how, well, the Bush administration was responsible for the end of the Cold War and the disintegration of the Soviet Union and the rising of the sun and a lot of other things. And Gore responded by saying, we were in on it too. He didn't deny, you see, that somehow neither of them could imagine that there are things that go on in the world that the United States has no control over, has very little control over. Both of them like to think that they were responsible. If not the Republican Party, the Democratic Party. If not either of them, both of them together. And so he was asserting, Gore was asserting that we had a bipartisan foreign policy. Now, I don't think it's been a good foreign policy. I don't think we've had a foreign policy. I'm talking, well, we can go back as far as we can in history. I'll go back temporarily. I don't know whether I'll feel like going back further, but at least temporarily I'll just go back to the post-war period, the post-World War II period, and say, you know, that our foreign policy, it seems to me, has not been based on really promoting democracy in the world, although that's very often what we think, or what we're told to think about our foreign policy. This is what we care about. We only want to promote democracy in the world. But looking at our foreign policy since the end of World War II, it hasn't seemed that way. That is, it seems that we have again and again not supported democracy in the world, but supported dictatorships in the world. We've done it in Asia, we've done it in the Middle East, we're still doing it in the Middle East. Kuwait and Saudi Arabia are not exactly democracies. In Latin America, we supported dictator after dictator after dictator, tyrant after tyrant after tyrant. And when we didn't have somebody in office that we liked, we would overthrow that government, or help to overthrow that government, or secretly overthrow that government, as we did in Guatemala and Chile. And usually the result was not democracy. Usually the result was a tyranny. And this was before Vietnam. With Vietnam, a lot of Americans began to question not only our policy in Vietnam, but our policy in general. People began to reconsider, because when they saw during the Vietnam War a pattern of deception of the American public, telling stories to the American public which turned out not to be true, stories about how we were doing this to support democracy, in Vietnam. People began to look beyond Vietnam and began to question our foreign policy in general. Now, the interesting thing about this foreign policy, what I would call an undemocratic foreign policy, a foreign policy really not designed to bring about justice in the world, but a foreign policy designed to enhance American power in the world. Now, I know there are some people who think, if you enhance American power, you automatically enhance justice and democracy. But I don't think that's true. And national power in itself is not a guarantee of democracy. So, if you look at this foreign policy, you see that it has been bipartisan. Both Democrats and Republicans have engaged in a foreign policy which was aggressive and expansionist and macho. Sure, the Soviet Union was aggressive and expansionist and macho, and we were aggressive and expansionist and macho. And I don't think I actually have ever used the word macho in a talk, but tonight, I don't know, I guess I feel macho tonight. We had Mexican food. That's what did it. We had Mexican food at dinner, and so here I am. You'll hear a lot of such words from me, I'm sure. It's common to think that, the Republicans are the conservatives and the Democrats are the liberals, and to a great extent that's true in domestic policy. In foreign policy, it's not true. In foreign policy, the Democrats have been as aggressive and as warlike and as militaristic as the Republicans, sometimes more so. We take a look at Harry Truman, and Harry Truman has been suddenly everybody loves Harry Truman. Everybody cites Harry Truman as their hero. Republicans, Democrats, I suppose it's, when you've had a run of mediocre presidents, anybody looks good. And people look back and they romanticize these, old presidents, and suddenly, and a new biography of Truman has appeared with 1,000 pages, And Truman did a few nice things. But in foreign policy, he was really an initiator of Cold War and of the idea of giving arms to dictatorships, and in his case, Greece and Turkey. You must give arms to them, even though they're dictatorships, because of the Soviet threat, communism, we must stop communism, and so on. But I've always been suspicious of the argument that our foreign policy was based on stopping communism, even though it's been used again and again. I mean, everybody knows this. It's been the centerpiece of our foreign... this is what we're going into Vietnam to stop communism. We're going into you know, invading Cuba to stop communism, we're overthrowing a government in Chile to stop communism, overthrowing a government in Guatemala to stop communism, you know, everything. That's a very nice way to present something because everybody wants to stop communism. And so it's a good way to get support for whatever you do in the world. But as a historian, I say, I start my sentence off as a historian to give tremendous weight to the words that will follow. Historians like to do this. The truth is, you know, historians differ on so many issues, but we like to throw our weight around. As one historian, how's that? That's more modest. As one historian, it always puzzled me that people should think that our aggressive foreign policy began with 1917. Because if our foreign policy is really based on anti-communism, then it must mean that, well, 1917 was the year of the Bolshevik Revolution, the year of the establishment of the Soviet Union. It must mean that before 1917, there's no problem. Before 1917, well, there's no need to throw our weight around in the world, no need to intervene, no need to send Marines anywhere in the world. Before 1917, there's no communist threat. But if you know even just a little bit of American history, you know that before 1917, the United States was an aggressive and expansionist power. First on our continent, on this continent. And we didn't get all this territory peaceably. No. We didn't get California and New Mexico and Colorado by persuading Mexico to give that territory to us. We fought a war against Mexico, a war which we instigated. I know we don't like to think that we instigated wars, but we have instigated a number of wars, and that was one of them. How did we get from the Atlantic to the Pacific? How did we move from a thin band of colonies along the Atlantic Ocean to a great continental power? We did it by conquest. We did it by Andrew Jackson going into Florida, although, you know, on those schoolroom maps it says, Florida Purchase. We mean it was just a commercial transaction? No, Andrew Jackson went into Florida and killed a number of people, and then Spain decided to sell Florida to us. Except that no money passed hands, actually. Florida Purchase. Mexican Cession. That's how it reads on the map. I remember. Mexican Cession. I mean, they just ceded it to us. Why? Just friendliness? No, we went to war against Mexico. And then took 40% of Mexican territory. We were an expansionist power. We expanded into the depths of this country, into the Louisiana Purchase, which I remember when I saw it on the map in the schoolroom, it looked like empty territory, right? There are no people there on the map. It's just empty territory, and it's ours, and we bought it for a bargain, $3 million, and it was only later that I realized there were people living in that territory, lots of people, Indians, Native Americans. They thought it was their country. They thought it was their land. No, we bought it right from under them, right? And then we annihilated them, either killed them or drove them out to make sure that it would be ours. We were an expansionist power continentally, long before 1917. And then, of course, at the turn of the century, we went into Cuba. Sure, we liberated Cuba from Spain, but not from ourselves. We drove Spain out and then put ourselves in, and put United Fruit in, and put our railroaders in, and put our corporations in, and wrote the provisions in the Cuban Constitution, which allowed the United States to intervene in Cuba anytime we felt like. And then we took Puerto Rico, a few bursts of cannon fire, and Puerto Rico is ours. We'll go to Hawaii, take over Hawaii, over to the Philippines, just a short, right? McKinley didn't know where the Philippines were. Thought they were off the coast of San Francisco. No, they're way out there, in the Pacific, near China, and we go over and to take the Philippines, fight a bloody war against the Filipinos, a war that you might say was a kind of a forerunner of the Vietnam War, a bloody war in which atrocities were committed. Filipinos did not want to be ruled by us, and they fought against us, but we defeated them after years of fighting. We became a world power, an expansionist, aggressive world power before 1917. Before 1917, we were sending Marines into every country in Central America. We were sending Marines into Haiti and the Dominican Republic for long occupations. We were bombarding the coast of Mexico because Mexico insulted us. Really, they arrested a couple of American sailors, claimed they were drunk, which is hard to believe. So we bombarded the Mexican coast to teach them a lesson. This is under Woodrow Wilson, our great liberal president. Now, I know some of you may think, hey, this man is down on the United States. You know, some people say, oh, wow, you know, this is anti-American. No, it's not anti-American. It's not anti-United States. It's anti-specific governments of the United States that have followed these policies. The government is not the country. The government is not the United States. The government is not American. Well, sometimes it is, maybe. But there are lots of times when it isn't, you know. And that's the job of the citizenry, to decide whether the government is behaving in accord with American ideals and to criticize the government when it isn't behaving in a decent way. So all this is happening before there's a Soviet Union. It suggests that our foreign policy, whatever the claim, oh yeah, we're doing this to stop communism, that our foreign policy has been motivated like the foreign policy of other nations, other great powers in the world, motivated by, yes, well, same motivations that moved the British Empire and the Dutch Empire and Spain and Portugal and France and all of them. The accumulation of power, the spread of influence, and also economic gain, corporate power, IT&T in Chile, United Fruit in Central America. So it's not that I'm singling out the United States. It's just that the United States, and this is a very hard thing for Americans, you know, born, growing up, saying a Pledge of Allegiance, you know, patriotism, and well, very hard for Americans to accept the fact that the United States is like other nations in the world. We're not the Boy Scouts of the world. We don't just go and help old people across the street. No, we don't. No, we behave like other imperial powers. That has been our foreign policy. And Democrats and Republicans have colluded in this. Truman got us into the Korean War. I say got us into the Korean War. I'm sure people collaborated, but you know, he was the president, and as they always say very proudly of Truman, he was the kind of guy who said, the buck stops here. Well, if the buck stops there, well, yes, he has some responsibility. And the Korean War is a good example of what wars are pretty much like. Almost a prototype of wars. I know wars are different, but the Korean War is typical in many ways because it starts with what seems like a good motive, a good cause. North Korea invades South Korea. No good, wrong. One country should not invade another country. Okay, a just cause. So, therefore, we go to war. Now that, let me not run too quickly over that, because that jump from just cause to just war is a jump that we should be very careful about. The fact that there is a just cause involved does not necessarily mean that war is the answer to the solution of that cause. Because very often, maybe always, war does not take care of that problem that you started out to solve, and in fact may make things worse. In the case of Korea, we fought for 3 years in Korea, a very ugly war. I know all wars are ugly, but a war fought with napalm and bombings of villages, and 1 million Koreans were killed in that war. 50,000 Americans were killed, 1 million Koreans. At the end of 3 years of warfare, where were we? North Korea was still a dictatorship. South Korea was still a dictatorship. Only 1 million people were dead. And that, I claim, is the situation that almost always prevails when you think that war is the solution to an injustice, to an aggression, to a tyranny, and so on. War multiplies the cruelties that you may have set out to amend. War multiplies the violence that you may have set out to stop. The means have overtaken the ends, and especially with modern warfare, where modern warfare is the massive, indiscriminate use of violence. When violence becomes massive and indiscriminate, you have lost sight of whatever the initiating moral was that you think you went to war for. Usually in a situation like this, talking about war in this nasty way in which I've talked about war, someone is inclined to think, well, what about World War II? Because whenever you get you get excited about the horrors of war, somebody says, yes, but what about World War II? That was a good war. Some of you may have seen Studs Terkel's oral history of World War II, which is entitled The Good War. You may have noticed that he puts it in quotation marks, The Good War. Because by the time he gets through interviewing all these people who participated in one way or another and were involved in World War II, he has to put quotation marks around it. The Good War. Well, maybe. I have a sort of special interest in that because I volunteered for the Air Force in World War II. I really didn't want you to think I was that old, but I wanted to claim that, you know, I was in some very recent war. But no, I was in World War II. I was a bombardier in the Air Force, and I flew combat missions, and I was an eager bombardier. And I believed in it as a just war. And after all, why not? Fascism was involved, right? Hitler, I mean, what could be a better cause? What is more horrible, more ugly, more vicious than fascism, Nazism, Hitler, the swastika, the goose step, you know, all of those, that paraphernalia of horrors that associated with it. And so, yes, I wanted to fight in that war. And yet at the end of the war, when I came home and I put my little mementos together in a little folder, almost without thinking, because I hadn't planned this, I wrote on the folder, never again. And as I wrote it, I was surprised by the fact that I'd written it. I said, hey, I thought this was a good war. But no, by the end of the war, it took on a much more complicated nature than simply a good, just, clean-cut war against fascism. It was no longer clean-cut, because wars are not clean-cut. Because you start off with a war against some monstrosity, and then after a while, you become a monstrosity. And so we went into World War II with horror at the fact that the Germans were bombing the Japanese, the Italians in Ethiopia and in Spain, that they were bombing civilians, just going over cities where civilians lived, dropping bombs on civilian populations, men, women, children. Now this is something new in warfare. It used to be just soldiers against soldiers, right? No, the fascists, they would do something like that. And so we go to war against them, and then we are doing that, only on a much larger scale. We are going over. The British Air Force, the American Air Force, going over and bombing civilian populations, not by accident, deliberately. Sir Arthur Harris of the British Bomber Command, they called him Bomber Harris. Strategy worked out, Churchill agreeing, the Americans agreeing, bomb the working class districts of German cities to destroy their morale. No pretense that we're bombing military targets. In Vietnam, very often there was a pretense, and Lyndon Johnson would say, oh, we're bombing military targets. That wasn't true. That was a lie, too. We bombed villages that had no military consequence at all in Vietnam. We had been horrified by 1,000 people killed in the German bombing of Rotterdam, Coventry. And now we bombed Dresden and killed 100,000 people in one night. Frankfurt, 70,000 people. Hamburg, 60,000 people. Tokyo became a sea of flames in which 100,000 people died in Tokyo. And then there's Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I know we can argue about, and people still argue about, oh, did we have to drop the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki? We can talk about that if you want to. But the point is, we became monstrous in fighting against something monstrous. And that's what war does. And some things take place. I participated in a bombing raid when the war was almost over, and we thought no more bombing missions. No more bombing missions. We were well into Germany. Overrun France, well into Germany. The war was going to be over in a couple of weeks, and we're called out of our huts at 1 o'clock in the morning to go on a bombing raid. Well, where? The Atlantic coast of France. The Atlantic coast of France. Yes, we're going to go bomb a little town on the Atlantic coast of France. Royan, near Bordeaux. Why are we going there? We've overrun France. We're into Germany. Well, there are a few thousand German soldiers there. They're holed up there waiting for the war to end. We're going to destroy that. Well, and so what's interesting to me now and what's horrifying to me now is that it never entered my mind, because I was such a trained soldier, and so I know how trained soldiers, I really understand. I understand how people, ordinary people and people of goodwill, can commit atrocities. It doesn't, didn't occur to me. Wouldn't have occurred to me. I would have thought myself mad. Other people would have thought me mad to stand up in a briefing room and to say, why are we doing this? The war is almost over. Why are we killing anybody in the last 2 weeks of the war? We know the war is over. Didn't occur to me. Follow orders. This is what you do. This is what you're trained to do. You go over, you drop these things. And the things were not the usual demolition bombs that we were accustomed to dropping, 500-pound demolition. They said, you're going to use something new today in your bomb bays. You're going to use canisters of jellied gasoline. That was napalm. Didn't know that word yet. Napalm. That's what we did. Destroyed the German soldiers and destroyed the town of Royan. And the French living, everybody, in, you know. Wasn't until afterward that I thought about this. I thought about the horror of it. And then when I was in Japan after the war, I spoke to a Japanese writer, a novelist named Makoto Oda, quite a famous novelist in Japan. He told me how he was a 15-year-old in Osaka, and after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and some of you may remember, a few days elapsed between Nagasaki and the actual, you know, official surrender. One day, about 3 days after Nagasaki, and about 1 day, well, 4 or 5 days after Nagasaki, and 1 day before the official surrender, he, a 15-year-old in Osaka, looked up, and the air raid sirens were blasting, and American warplanes were coming over Osaka to drop bombs and leaflets. The leaflets said, "The war is over." And with the leaflets came bombs. Strange. But in war, this is what happens. You get carried away. Nations get carried away. Commanders get carried away. Soldiers get carried away. And people are no longer human beings. It's a very good argument against going to war. Because once you go to war, you have no control over what happens. Whatever original moral purpose there was has become distorted. In other words, I've come to believe that whatever tyrannies exist in the world, whatever good causes there are, and there are many good causes, and there are many injustices that take place in the world, there are aggressions that take place, there are invasions that take place, there are tyrannies in existence, whatever they are. We don't want to accept them. We don't want to be passive in the face of them. We're opposed to them. We'd like to do whatever we can to do away with those injustices and those tyrannies and so on. But the one thing I am certain of is that war is no solution to these injustices. That we have to find other ways. That the human race is an amazingly intelligent species. Well, at least I think so sometimes. And we are. We're capable of incredible things. And it seems like such a gross stupidity on the part of these intelligent beings that the only way we can solve serious problems is by killing everybody in sight. It's always done, excuse me, it's always done with goodwill, you know, moral purposes. We're going to defeat fascism, we're going to defeat communism, we're going to show the North Koreans, we're going to get Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. You know, it's always good reasons. But the what happens then overcomes whatever good there was in that initial thinking. Well, of course, the Gulf War. See, the Vietnam War began to convince a lot of people of the things I'm talking about. The Vietnam War created an atmosphere in the United States, and all the surveys of the mid-1970s show this. Americans were turned off war, turned off military intervention. The Vietnam War just convinced a lot of Americans that, you know, we have to rethink this whole question. And survey after survey showed that Americans were not willing to go to war anymore. But the government of the United States did not want to accept this. And so they looked for ways to make war palatable. Let's find a nice little war that won't be costly. Let's go into Grenada. Remember Grenada? the reasons, you know. The great thing about wars, starting wars, you can always find reasons. Oh, we're going to save the medical students. Turned out the medical students didn't need saving. They're building a military airstrip. Turned out, no, it wasn't a military airstrip. It was a tourist airstrip. Yeah. The other Caribbean countries have asked us to do this. We've got to do it for them. No, it turned out that we had asked the other Caribbean countries to ask us to do the... And so, going to Grenada, oh, sure, not too many people get killed. What's a few hundred people or a thousand, right? In our time, that's nothing. We live in a time of inflation, right? Not long ago, the Wall Street Journal, and now, what is Grenada now, a thriving democracy? And you checked up? There was a little item in the Wall Street Journal which interested me. I'm an avid reader of the Wall Street Journal to see where my stocks and bonds and great holdings are. Occasionally I come across the Wall Street Journal, usually in an airport where some businessman has left it on the seat and I steal it. Wall Street Journal article says, well, first the United States invaded in 1983, and now there's an invasion of banks. St. George is the capital of Grenada, has 7,500 people, and 118 offshore banks, one for every 64 residents. This is a quote from the Wall Street Journal article. St. George's has become the Casablanca of the Caribbean, a fast-growing haven for money laundering, tax evasion, and assorted financial fraud. So we brought democracy to Grenada. Panama, right? Another. We've got to make war palatable again. Well, Panama, a good opportunity. Not much chance of our losing this war. And we've got the perfect enemy, Noriega. Ooh, look at him. A drug dealer, right? We don't tolerate drug dealers. We don't have any drug dealers. We just have Noriega. And he's responsible for all the drug dealing that's going on in the Western Hemisphere. If we just get him, right? So we do. We get him. And now drug dealing in Panama and everywhere around Panama is going on a bigger scale than ever before. Well, how many people were killed in the invasion of Panama? Not many. A few thousand? Who cares? That's not a big deal. So you see, we're getting people used to the idea of war again. And then comes Iraq. Even better. Maybe even a better villain than Saddam, than Noriega, Saddam Hussein. How can you beat that? The epitome of evil. He invaded Kuwait. Now, we can't stand for that. We can't stand for invasions. Now, of course, the fact is, we have stood for invasions. We have stood for lots of invasions. In fact, we have stood for our own invasions. When Turkey invaded Cyprus, we didn't go to war. When Israel invaded Lebanon, we didn't go to war. When Indonesia invaded East Timor, we didn't go to war. So we choose our spots, and we choose our causes, and so on. And they keep saying, we're going to bury the Vietnam syndrome. Remember hearing that? We're going to bury the Vietnam syndrome with the Iraq war. This is Deputy Undersecretary of Defense. Fortunately, the Vietnam syndrome lies buried in the Persian Gulf. And with increased public awareness that the expression of our national values can take military form. The expression of our national values can take military form. I like that. Yeah. And, a lot of talk like that. What do they mean by burying the Vietnam syndrome? They mean, well, making war acceptable by finding just the right enemy. After Ho Chi Minh, while he was a communist and so on, was not really, it was hard to make of Ho Chi Minh the epitome of evil. He's sort of a kindly avuncular figure, you know, and he was a very popular figure. He was a very popular figure in Vietnam, and, you know, but now we've got Saddam Hussein, he's invaded Kuwait, you know, which is true, an injustice, and so on. And furthermore, we're going to make this an easy war. And it was, right? An easy war. That will make war acceptable again. Very few American casualties. We won't count the Iraqi casualties, right? Because who are the Iraqis? Do they count? Do Iraqis count at all? Are they human beings? They're all Saddam Hussein. These Iraqi babies who die in the bombings, they're Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein lives. The babies die. A medical team, American medical team that goes into Iraq after the war finds that tens of thousands of Iraqi children have died as a result of the war. Not necessarily directly by the bombing, but by the bombing of the infrastructure, by the destruction of medical facilities, water supplies, and generators, and so on. So how do we say it's a war that was an easy war? It must be that we don't consider the Iraqis as human beings. And that's what war does to you. When you go to war, the enemy is no longer human. And the enemy is no longer the leader of the bad country. The enemy is everybody in that country, including the people who are being victimized by the leader. The very victims of the tyrants that you are out to get become your enemy. So, there's been this attempt to make war palatable again, which is a very dangerous thing, in my opinion. And there's something about the Clinton-Bush campaign which reminds me once again of the bipartisan nature of our foreign policy, Democrats and Republicans, because if you've noticed that Clinton does not want to be too critical of the Bush foreign policy, he's willing to separate himself from Bush on domestic policy, on health care, on education, and this and that, but he's not really willing to separate himself from Bush on foreign policy. Democrats want to be part of that. Clinton is willing to, well, cut the military budget, but not by much. The difference between what Clinton wants to cut from the military budget and what Bush wants to cut from the military budget is not very great. Clinton does not want to make drastic cuts in the military. He wants us to be a military power. He gets up on the stump and he says, you know, the United States must be number one in the world. Now, it seems to me, if we're going to have a new foreign policy, a really new foreign policy, if we're going to get away from war and militarism and the enormous waste of our resources, trillions, trillions of dollars of our resources wasted over the years, then we have to do something bold. And it's a lot easier to do it now that there's no longer the Soviet empire there. To renounce war as a way of solving problems in the world, as a way of bringing about justice. In the best moments of international cooperation, that has actually been expressed in the Kellogg-Briand Pact of 1932. the nations got together and they said, war, we're not going to use war. You know, in the UN said, you know, okay, World War II is over. Now we're going to remove the scourge of war from the. We have to decide. We're not going to be a war-making power. That's very hard, I know. As I say this, I'm like, what? America not be the one number one military power in the world? Why must we be a military power? Why can't we be a good country? Why can't we be number one, not in war making and not in how many bombs and jets we have? Why can't we be number one in the best record of infant mortality when now we're number 22? Why can't we be number one in having a health system for everybody instead of ranking down in the below, you know, Germany and Japan and Sweden and Denmark and England and France, in having health systems that cover everybody? Why can't we be proud of doing away with a situation where in the average age of death of a male in Harlem is 45 years old, which is like the average age of death of people in third world countries. There are 30, 40, 50 million people in this country who live under conditions of third world countries, whose kids live under conditions of third world countries. Why don't we come number one in that? Why must we think we must be number one? Colin Powell recently said, because the end of the Soviet Empire has led people to think, hey, maybe we can use all those hundreds of billions to take care of people's needs. But, oh, they don't want that. One of the reasons for going to the Gulf War is to dissuade people that, no, who knows, there might be another Saddam Hussein around. So let's continue spending trillions of dollars. Let the cities be as they were, right? Let the cities fester. Let the environment get polluted. Let the kids die as they do, you know, before the age of one. Every year, 45,000 kids under the age of one die. Infant mortality. Let that go on. But, Colin Powell recently said, again, like all the others, worried about people might ask for, you know, what they call a peace dividend. He said, we mustn't let down our guard. We must be prepared to fight two wars. They have this thing about how many wars we should be prepared to fight. Under Kennedy, they said we had to be prepared to fight 2.5 wars. That means two big wars and a little war. Nixon said we had to be prepared to fight 1.5 wars, a big war and a little war. Colin Powell says we have to be prepared to fight two wars. Let me see if I can find this interesting thing that Colin Powell said. He said, I want everybody to be scared to death of us. I don't say that in a bellicose way. That's a great statement. I want everybody to be scared of us, but I don't say that in a bellicose way. Scared to death of us. Is that what I want for America? Is that the image, that's the America that I grew up believing? Everybody should be scared to death of us, you know. I think we need a new policy in which we renounce war, we renounce militarism, we renounce the arrogance of George Bush saying, as he said in 1988, when he accepted the nomination in New Orleans to the Republican Party, he said, This has been called the American century, you know, a century in which the United States was the big power. And what shall we say about the next century, the 21st century? I say this will be another American century. I thought, why should this be an American century? We're only 6% of the world's population. What kind of arrogance is that? Why can't this be a century for everybody? Why can't the United States take its 6% place in the world? And why can't this be a century for people in Somalia and people in Latin America and people in the Middle East and people everywhere? It's that psychology, it seems to me, that we have to put aside if we are going to have a new foreign policy. Because only if we, and I think we have a basis for it. I'm looking at my watch to pretend that I care. Let me just go back to Clinton for a minute. Clinton seems to want to, as he says, change economic policy, health, education, priorities, and so on. He cannot do this. He cannot change our domestic policies and our domestic possibilities unless he changes our foreign policy. Because if we are going to keep on spending $275 billion a year, that's money that is, as Eisenhower once said, Eisenhower, hardly a radical, Eisenhower said, every dollar spent for the military is taken out of the mouths of children. I believe it is possible to have a new foreign policy, especially now that all this has happened in the Soviet Union, and despite the war in Iraq, which momentarily gave people a kind of cocaine high, you know, really, you know, wow, we won, and this and that, and, you know, but I think people are coming down from that and looking around and saying, so where are we now? I think it's possible to have a change in foreign policy. It's possible based on our needs, based on what has to be done in this country, what has to be done for human needs. American people are not naturally warlike. There are some people who think that we have wars because people are naturally war. People, you know, it's human nature. People, I don't believe that at all. And the historical evidence hardly supports that. Because if people sort of have a natural, spontaneous desire for war, governments would not have to go to such great lengths to get people to go to war. Governments have to work very hard to get their population to go to war. They have to propagandize them infinitely. They have to coerce them. They have to draft them. They have to threaten them with jail. They have to create an atmosphere in which it becomes unpatriotic to refuse to go to war. People generally have a revulsion against war. So if to create a new foreign policy is to base yourself on certain natural human desires, and especially if it, because people right now with these economic problems and joblessness and awareness of health difficulties and so on, and the LA riots and the city, with all of this, people are more aware that We've got to do something about this, and it takes resources. The possibility, I think, exists for a turnaround in our foreign policy so that we can have a turnaround in our domestic policy and so that we can create a really decent society, one that will be, you know, a model for other places in the world. And, you know, we are entering a new century. And this is a good time to decide that we don't want the 21st century to be a recapitulation of the last century. It's time for bold new directions to create a new kind of world. And I believe that for people to gather together, for people to meet together, for people to talk together, for people to join organizations, people to raise their voices, to speak up, to be more than voters, to be citizens. As Thoreau said, don't just vote. Vote with your feet. Vote with your hands. Vote with your whole body. Vote with all your energy. Vote all the time, not just by voting, you see. I think I'll end by just saying one more thing. Whenever a speaker says, I think I'm going to end, you always sort of hold your breath. Does he really mean it? Because a lot of speakers say, and in conclusion, and then about 20 minutes later, he concludes. I just flashed on something that I have to tell you. You see. It won't take 20 minutes. But there was a big fundraiser for the Republican Party. In order to come to this fundraiser, in order to be allowed to eat the hors d'oeuvres, you had to give $400,000. Somebody asked Marlon Fitzwater, whom everybody, I think, knows better than they know the Vice President of the United States. Somebody asked Marlon Fitzwater, why are these people paying $400,000? He says, well, the $400,000 gives them access. And it's an affirmation that they, you know, they believe in the way things are, and they want things to continue the way things are. It's their way of gaining access to decision making in the system. And so the reporter said innocently, but what if people don't have $400,000? Fitzwater said, well, I guess they will have to gain access some other way. Well, that's a clue to the rest of us. We will have to gain access some other way. So we have to start thinking about that. Thank you.
Agreed to answer questions from the audience. I'd like to request that Dr. Zinn please repeat the question so that everyone in the auditorium can hear what is being asked.
Yes. Excuse me?
Victims. And I always read it as you were giving another voice that we don't normally hear. How do you see yourself?
So, you're studying history and you've been reading some of my stuff, and you see me as giving voice to victims?
No.
I'm sorry.
And
yeah.
Others see you as speaking for victims. And I saw you as another voice of people that we normally don't hear from. How do you see yourself?
Explain to me that distinction. That is that there, she says, well, there's some people who see me as, what, speaking for victims?
Right.
And you see me as another voice.
Talking about Native Americans, blacks,
yeah,
women in history.
Right.
And normally they're not presented in most history books in any shape or form, or if they are, it's just a real small paragraph.
Yeah.
And that we read from your books, the class discussed it, and most people saw you as speaking out for victims of atrocities or suppression or oppression, however you want to put it. And I saw you as speaking out as another voice for these people who normally don't have a voice in history. As a writer and a historian, how do you see yourself as speaking for?
Okay. I guess the reason I was having trouble is because, you know, very often the people, she's talking about the distinction between seeing me as speaking out for victims and you seeing me as sort of giving voice to people who've been left out of the history books. And I guess since a lot of these people have been left out of history books are victims, right? And it was hard for me to make a distinction between those two. But I'll get to the last part of your question, which is, how do I see myself? In very heroic terms. I guess as a historian, you know, what I've wanted to do is recapture from history the voices and the points of view of people whose voices have been left out or whose points of view have been ignored. And so, I mean, example, Columbus, right? The big year of Columbus. And I tried, in the very first chapter of my book, well, you have to start a history of the United States, right? With Columbus, everybody does it, so. But I had decided in writing this history book, in deciding to write this history book, I didn't want to simply add another volume to the thousands of history books in the library. I wanted to do something that I thought was different and useful. And so I decided I wanted to write a history book from the standpoint, from the viewpoint of people who I thought were left out of history. And the people I thought were left out of history were, the Native Americans, the Indians, the black people. I mean, not that they're left out, but their point of view is missing. The black point of view is very different from the white point of view, for instance, on Abraham Lincoln, or on Franklin Roosevelt, or on the progressive period of American history. I taught in the South for 7 years. I taught and lived in a black community, teaching at a black women's college, Spelman College, in the years of the Civil Rights Movement. And you can't live in that situation, teach in that situation, without becoming somewhat aware that the black point of view is different than the white point of view. And in graduate school, I learned about the progressive period of American history, which is the first, you know, decades of the 20th century. Why is it called the progressive period? Because some reform laws were passed in that period, right? Congress passed some laws and Wilson signed them and the Federal Reserve System was set up and the Federal Trade Commission was set up and, you know, 16th Amendment was passed and 17th, you know, the usual stuff of American history. This is what Congress did, this is what the President did. And so it's the progressive period. But the progressive period, and I only really learned this after I got out of graduate school, after I had a doctorate, I was very often embarrassed after I had a doctorate in American history to learn how ignorant I was about so much in history. I learned that during this progressive period, more black people were lynched in this country, executed by death squads, to put it another way, than in any other period in American history. And this was called the progressive period. So the black point of view is different. Black point of view on Lincoln is different. No, he's not just the great emancipator. He freed us. No, Lincoln was a reluctant emancipator. Lincoln had to be pushed. Lincoln had to be urged. Lincoln had to be surrounded by the voices of a great anti-slavery movement. So I wanted to give voice to, these people and their point of view. I wanted to tell the story of American industrial progress from a different point of view than the one I had been taught When I went to school, I don't know how true this still is, although I suspected a lot of truth to it still. And we learned about the period between the Civil War and World War I, the period of the Great Industrial Revolution in America, when America became a great economic power, you know, that was the period when the great railroads spanned the country, and the steel industry, and the coal industry, and, you know, it was a sort of an exultant, exciting story of America becoming this great economic power. It was all a positive story. And I remember as going to school and learning this and feeling proud, wow, the Transcontinental Railroad, how exciting, the Union Pacific and the Central Pacific meeting, and the president driving a golden spike into, right? I don't know if they still tell you that. But it was only later, again, after I got out of graduate school, that I became aware about the people who were not mentioned, really, in the Industrial Revolution. The people who worked on these railroads. The Irish and Chinese immigrants who worked on these railroads, who died by the thousands on these railroads. The railroad workers who were killed by the thousands in railroad accidents. The girls who went to work in the textile mills of New England at the age of 11 and died at the age of 25. People worked 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. People worked in Rockefeller's oil refineries. You know, these were the heroes: Rockefeller, Carnegie, Mellon. You know, well, what about the working people, the farmers of that era? And so I wanted to tell American history from their point of view. Tell about our wars from the viewpoint of not the hero, the military heroes, the generals, the, you know, the statues that we see around and the slogans that we get in elementary school. But tell the story of wars from the standpoint of the GIs. The wars look different to them than did to the generals. The Mexican War, you can tell it from the standpoint of the Alamo and, you know, brave Americans and General Scott, Winfield Scott, on a triumphant march into Mexico City. You can also tell that from the standpoint of the American soldiers who woke up one morning on the way into Mexico City and asked, "What are we doing here? Why are we in this war? What are we fighting for? Real estate?" And they deserted. Seven regiments deserted. Different point of view. That's what I was trying to do. And so with Columbus, it was the point of view of the Indians. From their point of view, Columbus looks very different. Am I missing? Way back.
Yes, I wanted to thank you very much for your presentation. Very enjoyable and informative, but I wanted to clarify on the issue of strategies of doing away with war.
Yeah.
I thought I heard two different strategies, but they don't seem to be quite the same thing. One is perhaps summarized as just say no, swear off war.
What? Excuse me?
Just say no to war.
Just say no to war.
Okay. Abolish it by swearing off this habit that we've fallen into. The other, when you mentioned the United Nations, it seemed to me that you're pointing to another strategy, which is building structures of peace.
Yeah.
It seems to me to be very different from the first strategy. And I wondered which of these you see as the preferable alternative.
I assume you all heard that, right? Since I was able to hear it. If I can hear it, you can hear it. I don't see them as alternative strategies, saying no to war and building international structures, unless those international structures are going to make war. But I don't want that to happen. No, I see the two as complementing one another. Simply saying no to war is not enough. Just like saying no to drugs is not enough. You know, you have to do something to remove the sources of drug addiction and drug desire. Saying no is not enough. You have to do something about the economic problems of the world, and you have to mount an international effort to do something about rectifying the terrible inequalities in the world. You have to do something about international cooperation to try to have an effect on countries where terrible things are taking place, but to do it without war. Well, I mean, South Africa is a case in point. If anybody could find a just cause for war, they could find it in South Africa, where the majority of the black population has been in semi-slavery for a long time. And there is a just cause to change that situation and create some semblance of democracy and equality in South Africa. But war would not be the solution there. And even the African National Congress, which is a militant organization, African National Congress decided, no, it doesn't want war in which maybe several million black people would be killed. Maybe they'd win, but at a terrible price. The international community and sanctions against South Africa and, creating an atmosphere of condemnation of South Africa in the international arena, I think, had a great effect in beginning to change policy in South Africa. Obviously, have a long way to go in all these situations, but there has been the beginning of change in South Africa. And so I see those two as, necessarily complementary and not distinct from one another, not alternatives. I guess you think I don't see you. Yes.
I saw it was on Frontline, I think on Tuesday night, where it was, and I was passing out, and it was Friends Don't Let Friends Vote Republican bumper stickers. But at the same time, I saw this documentary on Tuesday night where Clinton was addressing the conservative Cuban elite in Miami. And he said, I think we should put the hammer down on Cuba and hold it there.
Yeah.
I think we ought to be real cautious in accepting his foreign policy as well.
And I think we ought to,
yes.
Yeah, I agree. I thought that I made clear that I was not happy about Clinton's foreign policies. He going along with the Bush foreign policy and trying to curry favor with the votes of Florida, the votes of Cuban Americans in Florida, by saying, I'm going to come down on Castro, just like the Bush administration is doing.
What inroads are there into that administration?
What inroads are there, I'm sorry?
What inroads do you see into that administration if it comes about on Tuesday?
In the Clinton administration?
Yeah.
What inroads?
Yeah.
What, do you mean what possibilities are there?
Sure, for working to change that.
For working to change that. I suppose with all that I say that's critical of Clinton, I guess I think there's at least more possibility of change with Clinton. With Bush, I really don't see a possibility of change. I see us just going along on the same track. With Clinton, there's at least a possibility of change, even though he does some ugly things. But I think, people have asked me sometimes recently, are you for Clinton? People want desperately to know what side you're on, if for. And what I have said is, I will be for Clinton for 1 minute. The minute that I'm in the voting booth, I'll be for Clinton. Before and after, I will be a harsh critic of Clinton. And the reason I will give him that minute in the voting booth has something to do with something that comes to my mind from history. And that is, when Lincoln was elected in 1860, Wendell Phillips, I don't know, some of you may know who Wendell Phillips was, but Wendell Phillips was a leader of the anti-slavery movement very eloquent and powerful leader of the anti-slavery movement. And the anti-slavery movement was not a friend of Lincoln, because Lincoln, they saw Lincoln as a waffler. That's how they saw Lincoln, as a waffler. You know, he'll talk one way in southern Illinois and another way in northern Illinois, depending on the votes, you know, and so on. It's always, you know, a little painful to think that about our Abe Lincoln. But he was a politician, he was a humanitarian and a very wise and eloquent man, but he's also a politician. And Phillips had criticized Lincoln very severely. In fact, at one point called him that slave hound from Illinois, because Lincoln had voted in favor of a Fugitive Slave Act in the District of Columbia. You know. But when Lincoln was elected in 1860, Phillips said this. This is as close as I can get to a quote. It's a pretty close paraphrase. He said, "Well, Lincoln is not an abolitionist. He's not an anti-slavery man. He's really a pawn on the chessboard. But with fair effort, we can convert him into a queen and sweep the board." And that was interesting. With fair effort. He understood, no, Lincoln is not what we want, but if we work at it, we can move him. And that's what happened. Lincoln was moved by the anti-slavery movement, by the pressures, by the huge numbers of petitions that came pouring into Washington from the anti-slavery movement, and so on and so forth. And he was pushed into the Emancipation Proclamation, into the 13th Amendment. And so that's how I think about Clinton. Somebody else. Yes.
I'm interested in the years that you spent at Selma, and this is in reference to another Frontline story 4 weeks ago about the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas.
About what?
About the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas
issue. Oh, the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas.
Right, and there was a Frontline special about how the black community reacted to that. And they interviewed some students from Selma, and they talked a lot about how women, especially in the black community, have had to always put feminism on the back burner for the sake of racism, or for the fight against racism. Mm. Do you have any comments about that from the black female point of view? Or?
Yeah, I certainly am the right one to give the black female point of view. But, no, it's an important question, and a good one. She asked about the Anita Hill Thomas things and about how they interviewed a young black woman from Spelman College, which is where I taught years ago, and these students talked about how black women had to put feminism, you know, aside in order to deal with race questions. And of course, the Thomas Hill hearings put black people, and especially black women, in a terrible position. Because on the one hand, there was a certain sort of natural sympathy for him, for Clarence Thomas, because he was a black man being appointed to the Supreme Court. And I remember Maya Angelou, the black writer, writing on, saying, well, it's true, he's been such a terrible reactionary in the past, but maybe if he's put on the Supreme Court, he'll remember his roots and his background, you know. And so there was this, you know, people were torn. And in fact, the polls that were taken in the black community indicated that more blacks were for Thomas than for Hill at the time. That may have changed. It has changed. And it has changed not only in the black community, but in the white community. But people have had second thoughts about all of that. I don't know what I can say about that, except that I just flashed on something else. You are subject to my flashes. And I remember just thinking of this difficulty, you know, of black women. I remember one of my students at Spelman College sitting in my office and saying to me, so when my mother sent me here to Spelman, she said, you know, you'd better do well. You know, you'd better make good. Because you have two strikes against you already. You're black and you're a woman. And so she was conscious of both. And, you know, the black women had to deal with this double problem of some of the new literature, some of the new novels by black women try very boldly to face this problem that black women can be victimized by black men, just as white women can be victimized by white men, and everybody can, all women of all kinds can be victimized by, right? I think Alice Walker and others have tried to do this. Alice Walker, by the way, was a student of mine at Spelman College. We teachers are always very proud of our students. And we always claim credit for whatever they do. Anything that our students did that is great, we are responsible for. If they end up as multiple killers, of course, that's not our fault. I don't know what to say about that, except to say, you know, that's been real, you know, that's a real difficult problem. And a lot of black people felt humiliated just by the fact that all of white America could sit at home at their television sets and watch two black people accuse one another of lying, you know, and so that no matter however you come out, some black person has done something wrong. Very difficult position. But on the other hand, in a certain way, it's a sign of progress that we've reached a point where, that the black community has reached a point where it maybe can begin to handle this. You know, it's strong enough to deal with this. And I read something by Toni Morrison, the black woman novelist, who said, well, and she's very against Clarence Thomas and for Anita Hill. She says, maybe it's time that we black people have come to the point where we're strong enough to deal with questions of right and wrong, even outside the boundary of race.